Good morning. The first case we have today is United States v. Sewell. Are counsel for the parties ready? Okay, we will hear first from the appellant.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Ryan Yoder, and along with my co-counsel, Major Christopher Coleman, we represent the appellant, Sergeant Todd Sewell. The special victims prosecutor's improper findings arguments in this case make it uncertain whether the panel relied solely on the evidence to convict the appellant. Namely, in spite of numerous warnings, the SVP made improper arguments that violated the military judge's rulings, as well as many other legal norms. Under the Fletcher test, these arguments were prejudicial because the misconduct was severe, the curative measures insufficient, and the evidence supporting the convictions were weak.
Thus, this counsel, what's the judge supposed to do? Defense counsel comes up and says, I want 10 trials. The judge says, that's a little impractical. Do you have anything else to offer? Defense counsel says, no. So what's the judge to do?
Well, Your Honor, clearly he could have severed the trial with perhaps the indecent conduct and the exposures versus the assault.
Well, he asked. Defense counsel didn't ask for it. He asked the defense counsel, you got anything else? Defense counsel says no.
Understood, Your Honor, but it was clearly in front of the military judge what the possibility of prejudice could be, and that even if the military judge didn't grant the motion for severance, it doesn't affect ultimately whether there is prejudice on the appellant as related to the improper argument or prosecutorial misconduct. And specifically, the categories of improper arguments that the SVP made here, in spite of three warnings not to do so, both based on pretrial motions, a warning right before opening arguments, and again before closing arguments. And in fact, the SVP specifically stated, I'm, quote, very careful when it comes to choosing my arguments. And here, as it relates to the 404B arguments, these at least two were addressed by the military judge. However, a multitude of others, and in fact, the defense counsel said at a minimum, these are specific issues, but there were multiple throughout. I'd like to highlight at least approximately five.
Well, is this an improper comment case or an IAC case where the defense counsel just sat there? We've got to do this on plain error if it wasn't objected to.
Well, Your Honor, it was objected to.
That's the basis for my first question. You know, when you don't get 10 trials, then what do you have?
Well, Your Honor, it doesn't require 10 trials. And with the joint trial, the military judge was on notice of the potential prejudice here.
And he was quite active.
At least he was up until closing argument. In fact, the military judge didn't interrupt, as it was his duty to do so, throughout the closing argument. And the defense counsel, there's a tactical reason for not interrupting the arguments, at least at the time, because they may not have wanted to draw attention to the numerous improper arguments.
Sure.
And as a result, they did properly raise this before their own argument, moving for a mistrial and raising it to the judge that there were improper arguments, at least as it relates to 404B. And then, of course, there's still plain error. As the military judge reviewed, and he stated to review the entire argument, and it should have been clear in front of the military judge that there were all these additional improper arguments, and thus those were plain error as well. And those include the vouching arguments, the facts not in evidence arguments, and those designed to inflame the passions of the panel. And specifically, especially as it relates to the improper arguments on the 404B, in analyzing the prejudice regarding specifically comments related to the 118 picks and the take no for an answer, the military judge here did not exhaust all his possibilities for remedies, and the curative instruction here was not sufficient.
Counsel, let me ask you a question here. I may have misheard you just a second ago. Did you say the military judge had a duty to interrupt?
Well, Your Honor, at least when he becomes aware that there are possibilities of inappropriate character evidence and hearing them come through, the military judge did have an opportunity to interrupt counsel during it and to address those arguments on the record. especially as it relates to improper vouching arguments. And I direct the court's attention to the arguments related to that whether or not she was making it up. And there the 05 senior SVP was placing his force in the weight of his not only rank but office as SVP behind the fact that she was not making it up. This was also objected to earlier in the trial when this SVP attempted to elicit the same from Ms. JF regarding whether she thought it was making it up. And this is human lie detector, as the judge saw. But as it relates to the improper argument, here the SVP was clearly on notice that that was an improper argument to make, and he made it anyway.
So that's an instance where you say the judge may have had a duty to jump in at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. He understood that he had made a ruling earlier in the proceedings, and then once he heard that, it was very clear that that's what this was related to, and he could have stopped the proceedings and issued an instruction. Or as an alternative, and this goes to the overall curative remedies, he could have precluded the not only gave an instruction then, but also precluded the government from making a rebuttal argument. That's particularly important here. Yes, Your Honor?
Or could the military judge also have simply called the parties up to the bench and asked defense counsel whether there was some tactical reason why he was not objecting to that information at that time?
He could have, Your Honor. It's not clear on the record. However, it is absolutely one of the possibilities that it was a tactical decision. However, the defense counsel did bring it to the government's attention in requesting multiple mistrials, both before after the original findings argument and again on the rebuttal. And that's why the curative measure of preventing a rebuttal argument would have been successful here. It would have prevented an additional improper argument where, even though the military judge addressed whether or not the argument relating to testing, and this is where the SVP stated that this was Sergeant Sewell, quote, once again testing. The military judge made an erroneous finding when that was a statement related to only one individual, when in fact he was referring to all. And thus, that was also an improper argument that was raised by the defense and properly, it should have been properly excluded and was not, there was no curative instruction on it. Thus, it appears that they were prejudicial.
The only reason I asked about your comment about when the military judge should jump in or not is that in the instances that you say that he should have jumped in and interrupted the argument because of this egregious error that was occurring, that would suggest that the defense counsel was ineffective, would it not?
Two responses to that, Your Honor. There could be a tactical reason not to do so. Obviously, this court can find that it is potentially ineffective not to raise them at the time.
I don't know if we would do that to respond to it. I mean, I'm just wondering why that, or if that is part of what your complaint is that this was not only an egregious problem for the military judge not jumping in and interrupting the argument, but counsel may very well have been ineffective for, number one, not objecting, number two, not proffering to the military judge that he has no problem with it one way or the other. That's what I'm trying to figure out here, is that if the argument is so egregious that it calls for the military judge to take this extraordinary measure, then what is the defense counsel's responsibility?
Your Honor, it very well.
Now, I understand in your case there are times when the defense counsel objected strenuously and got the judge to give a cautionary instruction. I understand that. But on some of the other instances in the argument by the trial counsel in this case, the defense counsel didn't object, or maybe I think that he objected later on after the argument, but was that considered kind of a global objection to the argument, or what? You know what I'm saying? I understand why the defense counsel doesn't jump in.
Yes, sir.
All the time, because there is a tactical reason why he or she might not do that. But what I'm wondering is that what about those instances where defense counsel didn't object and then after the argument didn't bring it up, and now on appeal you're adding those to the list of egregious conduct on the part of the prosecutor when defense counsel had a chance to address it?
Well, I believe the distinction here, Your Honor, is twofold. One, the defense counsel also has the opportunity to raise those, but here the defense counsel made an objection saying at a minimum there were these four instances, and clearly intimating to the military judge that there were additionals.
Okay. So that's, I just want to make sure that what I understand what your position is that maybe the defense counsel, from your point of view, didn't want to object to every single thing, go down this big laundry list of faults, but instead just wanted to interject his or her objection to the argument as a whole, kind of a global.
Yes, Your Honor, and it was clear by their statement that as a minimum, this is what was wrong with the argument. And clearly, once the military judge did go back and re-review the argument, and that's clear from the record, he should have been on notice that all of these were potential errors, especially as it relates to his previous rulings in the case, as well as in some of these are fairly egregious in terms of whether or not associating Sergeant Sewell to a man in a trench coat, as well as associating him, or at least calling him a sexual predator, and stating that the military has higher standards, quote, especially as it relates to these 8 or 9 victims over this 9-month period. And there's a direct correlation to convicting him based on a propensity rather than specific evidence in the case.
Counsel, he did make some incriminating statements to CID, i.e., first he lied to him, and then he said, well, yeah, she was in my room, and I did send her a text and tell her to please keep quiet about this. In view of his incriminating statements and the fact that the members acquitted him of a significant number of the charges, how's there prejudice here, regardless of what trial counsel said?
Yes,
how's there prejudice here?
Yes, Your Honor, three answers to that. First, whether the panel rendered mixed findings here cuts both ways. This could be a relatively close case, which we agree it is. It was credibility determinations were important here. Whether or not he, quote, lied, whether or not the PFC-MN made inconsistent statements, her character for untruthfulness was at issue. So clearly this was a he said, she said. And the arguments here that went unchecked by the military judge, the improper vouching, especially related to the SVP, the SVP's rank here leads one to believe that where there's this tips in favor of prejudice, the prong 1 and 2 of the Fletcher factors can still heavily weigh in favor of the appellant to overcome where it's a close call on the third prong. Here, because of the mixed findings, it was a close call, and thus the severity and the lack of curative measures related to especially improper vouching, the multitude of other arguments he made related to facts not in evidence, especially that when the SVP was clearly referencing a medical diagnosis when he said there's something wrong with him, we can't say what it is, but he has issues, and those issues are dangerous and criminal. Thus, clearly showing that prong 1 and 2, the severity of the misconduct, and here a lack of curative instruction not only in general, but commensurate with the SVP's rank. So even the instructions provided by the military judge on the first two arguments, meaning the 118 pictures and the if he doesn't take no for an answer, the military judge should have been on notice based on the SVP's position and rank that he needed to do a little bit more to show and convey, as we cited in our brief, that there was a sufficient sense of disapproval such that the panel would have disregarded those arguments.
What was the rank of the members of the panel?
Yes, Your Honor. The president was an 06. Lieutenant Colonel Simmons was the only lieutenant colonel. There was an 04, I believe, 2 or 3 CSMs and 1 E8. In fact, Colonel McDonald was the...
Yeah, enlisted was requested, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm talking about the officer members.
Yes, Your Honor.
An 06, an 05, and what?
And an 04, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, getting back to Judge Stuckey's question about the incriminating statements, wasn't there a more benign potential reason for the accused in this instance to initially state that he didn't have a female in his barracks room and then later admit it and ask her not to disclose it to others?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The statements made by Sergeant Sewell didn't, confess, so to speak, to criminality. And there was another reason for him to make inconsistent statements throughout his statement to CID. And this was compounded by the improper argument by the SVP stating that he lied, also regarding, rather, not just that he lied, or in fact that he believed he lied is the problem, isn't that the improper vouching is the error here. And that's what added to the prejudice related to that. It makes it unclear whether the panel truly convicted him without reference, solely on the evidence.
Counsel, are you going to move to prejudice at this point specifically? No, and I understand that it's not your burden to show once error has been established, but I assume you have a view that all of this ended up with prejudice to your client, and you fill in the blank. Because the only reason I ask is that because I think the accused in this case was charged with a number of offenses, but was acquitted of almost half of these offenses. So what are we to make of that with regard to prejudice? Because one could conclude that the members were, in fact, in spite of or notwithstanding counsel's argument, they were still doing their own thing and evaluating the evidence and sifting through it and determining what the accused is guilty of, what he is not guilty of.
Two answers to that, Your Honor. First,
I know you don't have much time left, but please go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. There are two answers, one of which is that it cuts both ways. The mixed findings by the panel do evince an intent that they were looking at the evidence, but it could have been a close call on all the charges for them. And there the improper arguments were what specifically tipped the balance in favor of guilt for those specific specifications. And the backup to that argument, Your Honor, may I finish?
Please go ahead.
Really is that the multi-factor test for Fletcher does not require an actual finding that the panel was dissuaded or there was some actual issue there. Rather, the first two factors in this case weigh so heavily that this inconclusiveness of the third factor and the inability of the fact that it cuts both ways leads to a showing that there was prejudice in this case.
Did they have the pictures? Were the pictures introduced into evidence?
They were, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel. You'll have time on rebuttal. We'll hear from the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Linda Chavez, and along with Major Cormick Smith, represent the government in this matter. This court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case because after the balancing the factors from United States versus Fletcher, the minimal errors in the trial counsel's argument did not prejudice the appellant.
Counsel, is it the government's position that an SVC should be held to a different standard of trial advocacy than a typical trial counsel would be held to?
No, Your Honor. An SVP, along with any other trial counsel, whether it be a brand new trial counsel, should all be on the same level. In this case, we're really looking at prejudice because there were two instances of plain error that occurred where the trial counsel used the terms, we know it wasn't accidental, we all know she didn't make this up, and the frequent use of we know in that context was plain error. Because as Fletcher states, it's improper vouching, and especially when you use the use of personal pronouns in connection with a witness. Fletcher also prohibits disparaging comments about the defense counsel. And in the trial counsel's rebuttal argument, he stated that something along the lines that the defense had a poker face, and that was improper. But it was not, because there was no objection, this court reviews for plain error. The comment about the poker face was wrong, but it wasn't as severe as the comments that were made in Fletcher. In Fletcher, there were repeated comments about the defense itself, as far as it being nonsense, fiction, unbelievable, ridiculous, and phony. And the trial counsel in Fletcher also compared her style of questioning versus the defense counsel. The trial counsel in Fletcher pretty much painted the defense counsel as somebody evil, somebody who cut off witnesses, would yell at people, intimidate people, and that wasn't the case here. In this case, the term of the use of the word poker face was just a parting comment, and that stopped right there. He just took it too far, but it stopped, and he continued on with his rebuttal argument.
So the government confesses error.
For that, those two instances,
right.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So just to be clear, poker face, you're conceding?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was a misstatement?
It was improper, yes.
What about the situation where there had been a sanity board conducted in this case, and the military judge told the SVC that he could not introduce that evidence unless he laid the proper foundation? But then you had the trial counsel say, quote, and this is to the panel, something's wrong with him. We can't say what it is, but he's got issues, and his issues are dangerous, and they're criminal. Why isn't that particularly damaging to an appellant? Now, the panel members didn't know about the sanity board, but it puts into context what the trial counsel is trying to convey here. He's talking about he's got issues. We all know what that means in the modern context in terms of psychological issues. And then he's saying he's dangerous. Why wouldn't that lead the panel members to believe that the trial counsel knows something that the panel members don't about the psychiatric condition of this person that makes him dangerous?
Because it was just a fair comment on the evidence. There were 10 individuals listed.
But it wasn't in evidence. The military judge specifically said sanity board could not come in unless the proper foundation was laid.
The term something's wrong with him was just the overall context of the trial, of the fact that he continued to send photos of his penis to individuals, the fact that he kept exposing himself and he masturbated on somebody's foot, and the fact that he laid on top of somebody while he was naked and erect and attempted to rape her. So it was just a comment on the evidence itself and not necessarily the condition that he had that was a result of the 706 board, Your Honor.
So what was as I understand it, the photos, that the specifications involving the photos were actually introduced?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so that leaves two specifications, both involving PSC and M.
Yes, Your Honor.
That he was convicted of.
Aside from the photos? Yes, Your Honor.
Yes.
Yes.
And what was the evidence supporting, were they the same offenses, the two different specifications? Were they talking about the same event?
Yes, Your Honor, they were.
What was the evidence supporting those specifications?
Testimony of PSC MN. She testified that she pushed him off and he was trying to pull her shorts down and he was on top of her. She ran away and ran into JF, who testified about the fact that she was borderline hysterical when she encountered her. We have appellant's admission to CID where he admitted that he was rubbing lotion on his groin and had an erection and went over to PSC MN to lay on top of her. And we have the fact that appellant lied to his friend, Sergeant Lefferts, and stated that PSC MN was not in the room at all. Now, regarding the two instances where there was a sustained objection, regarding the comment at JA 157-158, where the trial counsel stated that what kind of man has 118 images of his cell phone, on his cell phone, of his penis, and also at JA 158, where the trial counsel stated the fact that appellant doesn't take no for an answer when he kept sending the photos, just like he didn't take no for an answer when PSC MN told him no and was pushing him off. So that tie-in from the photos to the actual attempted rape was improper. And the military judge stated that it was improper. Right after the trial counsel finished his argument, there was a recess. The judge listened to the argument one more time. Then he came back and told the members that there was parts of the argument that were improper. He explained about the fact that the 118 images to paint the accused at that point as some type of pervert was improper. So he told them to disregard it for that purpose. He told them it was improper to argue that sending photographs after somebody said no, that as a general proposition, that didn't take no for an answer, and it could be used for all the charges, that was improper and that should disregard it as well.
From your view, should an instruction that has been given late in the proceedings be viewed as being less curative than something that has been given more timely?
Not in this case, Your Honor, because The very first thing that the panel heard when they came back, when the trial counsel had already sat down, was the fact that he did something wrong. The military judge immediately said, like, what he did was improper. These are the two things that were improper, and this is how you're supposed to use the evidence. So in this context, the very first thing out of the military judge stated was he was wrong, and it cured it in that sense. And the military judge also went over the spillover instruction again, and then he explained how they could actually properly use the evidence of the photos if they believe that the photos were actually of Appellant's penis and if it was actually his phone with those photographs on there. They had to find that before they could use that evidence towards the other offenses.
And is it your position that that curative instruction covered all of the errors that you've conceded?
Yes. And for the findings argument, yes, Your Honor.
Captain Chavez, now, what's the court supposed to do with a case where it sounds like you, the government, have conceded certain errors, right? And the military judge during the trial recognized some and gave some curative instructions there. But this was a very experienced trial counsel, was it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And so what's the court supposed to do with a case like this where you have, you know, almost a fairly serious number of instances where an experienced trial counsel seems to be kind of testing the limits, maybe not, but or maybe the counsel is simply so emotionally involved in the case. I understand that happens sometimes. But we have these cases that say, hey, look, you're not supposed to do this, you're not supposed to do that. When you're the trial counsel, because of your position as the government representative during the trial, are we supposed to be concerned about deterrence, or are we supposed to be kind of focused on the overall bottom line, which is whether the accused did, in fact, get a fair trial?
This court should focus on the overall bottom line.
Well, if that's the case, what do we do about these continued instances? I mean, Fletcher was fairly explicit about what you should and shouldn't do, was it not?
It was, Your Honor.
And yet, I mean, how long ago was Fletcher? It wasn't an age ago. I won't test your memory on
2005, Your Honor.
For some folks, that might be a long time ago, but maybe some folks like us, that's not a long time ago. So my question, I guess, is should we be concerned about some kind of deterrent effect? Because the message, at least with respect to this counsel, does not seem to have been taken. What do you think about that?
The legal question is whether or not the cumulative effect prejudiced the appellant. And in this case, it did not, because the errors in this case were far less than Fletcher. They were far less or far egregious than Hornback, where in Hornback it was an attempt to continuously get improper character evidence into the record to pretty much every witness that was called on the merits. That didn't happen here. Mm-hmm. It was just strictly confined to the findings argument and to the initial findings argument, but for that one comment in the rebuttal argument itself about the poker face. But overall, the cumulative effect is far less than Fletcher and Hornback. And any of the comments that he made did not rise to constitutional error of what he could have said. But at the end of the day, the bottom line is, regardless of his experience or regardless of his inexperience, wrong is wrong, and it's just a matter of the cumulative effect on the trial itself and whether or not the panel convicted appellant on the evidence.
And how do we know they convicted him on the evidence?
We know that the panel followed the military judge's instructions based on the mixed findings. They did not convict him on any of the offenses regarding his actual exposure of his penis in front of somebody's presence or when he's masturbating in front of them. It was all confined to the photos and the attempted rape.
Don't we know that there's no way of knowing what has gone through the collective mind of a jury or a panel in terms of how they've decided something? So getting back to Judge Stuckey's question, how in a case like this can we have confidence that, in fact, it was based on properly admitted evidence?
You look at the weight of the evidence that was in this case, especially his admission to CID that put him in that room, that had him naked with an erection, laying on PFC-MN. The fact that the photos were admitted of his penis, that they all recognized, and the testimony of all the victims collectively. So overall, given that the weight of that evidence and the balance of the Fletcher factors, this court can be satisfied that appellant was convicted on the evidence presented in front of them.
Counsel, in your brief, you referred to the fact that the misconduct wasn't severe because it was limited to the findings. I'm not quite sure I understand your point there. Could you explain it, please?
Yes, Your Honor. It wasn't like the situation in Hornback where it was throughout the entire trial, where throughout all the witnesses that were called during the case in chief, where they're trying to elicit improper character evidence. In that case, it was about, they were trying to elicit prior drug use and paint the accused in that case as a drug addict. And it was a constant interruption from the military judge and curative instructions throughout each witness and the argument itself, which was the issue and what was improper. In this case, the improper comment or the improper conduct of the prosecutor was just confined to his argument itself. It wasn't spread out throughout the trial, Your Honor. Subject to any questions? In considering the entire trial, the curative measures from the military judge and the strength of the government's case, the improper argument did not prejudice the appellant, and we ask this court to affirm the findings and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
Counsel, given the government's concession that there was error, right, my concern is this, is if he's acquitted of everything except for the offenses to which there's physical evidence introduced supporting those charges, or to which he basically made many inculpatory statements, like, what is the prejudice?
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, because it seems like you're saying, well, they did something bad, and yes, they did something bad, but that's not the end of the inquiry, right? We need to have prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor, and here, as it relates to those picture specifications, for lack of a better term, here it's unclear whether or not collectively, even though the evidence there was strong, the two other Fletcher factors still weigh very heavily in favor of the appellant, because there were unchecked statements, as the government admits, and those were directly related to comments made by the defendant.
So is it your contention that your client can have relief even if he wasn't prejudiced?
No, Your Honor.
Based on the strength of the other Fletcher factors?
No, Your Honor.
Because it sounds like that's what you're saying.
No, Your Honor, I'm saying that there is prejudice because when weighing all three Fletcher factors together, the first two weigh sufficiently, even if the third factor is inconclusive, based on the mixed findings, that when weighing all three together, it concludes a finding of prejudice as it relates to all the charges and specifications. And the reason for that is even though he was found guilty of the picture specifications, those weren't a foregone conclusion. They didn't specifically, many of the victims there did not specifically state that was the picture that I saw. A couple of them were saying they are like the pictures that I saw. Furthermore, because of the general criminal propensity that was argued in those vouching statements, it's unclear whether or not, the panel did find them guilty of maybe stronger charges, but not beyond a reasonable doubt charges potentially, and that could have been the factor that put them over the edge in more of a close case. So
what's the to borrow from our former chief judge, what's your best argument? What had the most prejudicial effect?
If I may, Your Honor, and I see I'm running out of time. May I take
go ahead.
Is it spillover? Is it vouching? Or are you arguing, as you seem to be, at the rear of your brief, structural error?
Three answers to that, Your Honor.
I just want one.
Okay. One answer to that, Your Honor.
Are you arguing that it's cumulative, that all these errors put together are enough?
Yes, Your Honor. When viewed in totality.
In other words, what you're saying is they're all about the same, but the cumulative effect is prejudicial.
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Chief, may I ask a question?
Please.
I'm interested in your other two responses.
Thank you, Your Honor. One of those is, as alluded to by yourself, Your Honor, especially as it relates to the experience of the SVP and the fact that he was a former military judge. Those weigh and heavily impact the prejudice analysis. And they impact the two prongs in the prejudice analysis, the severity prong and the curative instruction prong. And the fact that he was a senior prosecutor, the panel knew he was an SVP, and they knew that he was, in fact, an O5. So clearly that makes the military judge on notice that whatever curative instruction he needs to provide, he needs to do them heavily.
Did the panel know he was a former judge? How could they?
Not a former military judge, Your Honor, okay. But that impacts a separate analysis, and that's.
But you suggest that there's a sliding scale of performance, you know, and there isn't. I mean, there's a standard that everyone is supposed to meet.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I'm not arguing that as related to whether there was error. This is purely to whether or not there was prejudice, and what.
So if you'd been a captain, there'd be less prejudice.
Potentially, Your Honor, and the argument there is twofold because. One of the sub-factors in prong one of severity is whether they abided by the military judge's ruling. Here, the fact that he was a former military judge and a senior experienced member can give rise to the fact that he knew and he didn't follow and he should have known. And that makes the conduct more severe. And secondarily, as it relates to his rank, it's important for the panel who saw the highest ranking judge advocate in that courtroom making specific arguments, vouching for evidence and witnesses, and thus, again, make the second prong of the prejudice analysis weigh in favor of the appellant.
So you think that a lieutenant colonel of a colonel, didn't you say a colonel was the president of the panel?
Yes, Your Honor.
You think the colonel would be more persuaded by the argument of a lieutenant colonel than he would be by a captain?
I think.
Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, I'm not saying it always will, but I'm saying there is a potential. And that potential
And why is that? Because the captains don't know anything or what? Aren't you a captain?
Yes, Your Honor. I will not say they don't know anything, but I will say that there's an idea, just generally in the military, that with experience comes weight of one's advice. And there's a reason why O6s advise generals and the like. Not to say that their advice is wrong, but obviously they have more experience in that realm such that they would give those advice. And there's a potential there. And I'm not saying in every case it will, but the military judge needed to at least know that, evaluate it in making his curative instructions or providing any remedies in this case.
How would he have included that in his instruction, the disparity of the rank?
Your Honor, he could have stated... he could have either made explicit reference to the rank.
Would that have been appropriate?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. If he thought, and this is not in every case, in this case it may not have been appropriate, but what would have been appropriate is under these circumstances, the instructions occurred later, but he also could have interrupted the SVP during the improper arguments. And given weight, and I think that's the important thing, expressing a sufficient dissatisfaction where you have a former military judge who disobeyed one of your rulings and argued it to the panel. And doing so would have conveyed to the panel an individual of O5 rank just did something wrong here other than saying, Colonel McDonald made two improper arguments, and please follow my instructions.
In other words, he should have been nastier.
Not necessarily nastier, Your Honor, but
well,
at least...
Seems to be what you're that doesn't call for it.
Firmer.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. The Court thanks Counsel for both parties, and the Court is in recess until 10:20.
Court stands in recess until 10:20.